Hi, I'm Emma Martins, and you're listening to The Longest Battle here on RNIB Connect Radio. The reason I decided to do The Longest Battle is because I caught a virus in 2013 when I was on holiday in Vietnam. It changed my life forever, and as a result, I had to pretty much learn everything again, from the simple task of crossing a road to making a cup of tea. So I decided I would talk to other people who have gone through life-changing situations. Today, I'm lucky enough to talk to Trisha Goddard, who's best known for her TV chat show, Trisha, which first aired on ITV before moving to Channel 5. In The Longest Battle with Trisha, we will hear about her early TV career, her own battle with breast cancer whilst still presenting and hosting Trisha, dealing with depression, and her own way of dealing with mental health issues. Not only that, finding out that she was adopted and dealing with her own anxiety and depression. I began by first asking Trisha about how she first got into TV and how her TV show Trisha came about.
Oh my gosh, really, my television career started when I was about 13 or 14, and I used to be obsessed with making movies. And my stepdad had an old Cine 8 camera, and I used to muck around with it and make movies. So I made one year. I used a, people don't even use that technology anymore. And I sent it into BBC Young Film Director of the Year Award, and I won a runner-up prize. And the prize was a cement splicing machine. That's how you used to put films together, yeah, with cement. And so I won that, and I entered it the next year. And the next year, I also got a runner-up. And with this annoying, we went to meet John Craven, and it was this annoying little boy with near me who did these stupid plasticine figures. And it was funny, many, many, many years later, I was at Buckingham Palace, actually, at a reception for the media, and this chap bounded up to me and said, "You don't remember me. I was a runner-up for Young Film Director, BBC Young Film Director." He was quite a bit younger than me, and I said, "Oh, God, the kid with the plasticine figures." And it was Nick Parks who went on to do Wallace and Gromit.
Okay.
So together we went to find John Craven and said, "We were runners-up." And he said, "Oh, wow." And we said, "Who won that year?" And he said, "I don't know." And we said, "Exactly." You know, but it started then, really. It was always a hobby. But I actually, and I did lots of courses while I was a stewardess and other things. But I actually got into television when I was 28 years old in Australia.
Okay.
With SBS. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. And how did you move into London? What happened then? You moved to London?
Well, I started in television. I started with News and Current Affairs in Sydney, in Australia, because I've got dual nationality, British Australian. And I did News and Current Affairs until right after I had my daughter, and I was 32, my eldest daughter, and then I just couldn't do News and Current Affairs anymore. And I'd always been interested in health and social welfare. Mm-hmm. So the ABC in Australia, like the BBC, said, "What would you like to do?" And I said, "I'd like to do a health and social welfare program," which we did, called Everybody. From that, I formed my own production company and made a show called Live It Up, which was a half-hour daily talk health show. So it was a bit like The Doctors, if you know that show called The Doctors, with an agony aunt and what have you. And then I was headhunted. You know, I got this message on my answer machine saying, "You don't know who I am. My name's Malcolm Allsop. I'm with Anglia Television, and we're looking for somebody to do a show." You know, I was like, yeah, right. So he flew out to Australia to see me. And I was just telling somebody today, funnily enough, the show they wanted me to do was what was provisionally called The L Room, which was the forerunner to Loose Women. That's what I was brought over to do. But very quickly, the whole thing with Vanessa happened. She resigned. Mm-hmm. And within, I landed on the Friday. It was bank holiday Monday. On the Tuesday, I started my British talk show. And the rest, as they say, is history.
And how long were you doing the Trisha show for?
Well, I started in 1998 and then I took it to Channel 5 in 2005 and I left Channel 5 in 2009. So
quite a long time.
And then I filled in on Maury for the in the States. They asked me to come over and do conflict resolution. And of course I worked through my breast cancer diagnosis, my operations, my chemo, radiotherapy and what have you in 2008. So I was rather happy at going to the States once every few weeks to work on Maury. And it rated so well. So then they asked me to come to the States and do my show again. So if you add that bit in, it's another 3 or 4 years in the States as well.
Now that we've heard about how Trisha got into TV and started her own TV show, Trisha, I was keen to find out when she first realised that she was suffering with depression. In fact, I was there working on her TV show at the time when Trisha stood up and said that she was dealing with depression and anxiety.
In hindsight, probably went through many cycles of depression. But, you know, if nobody tells you what it is, and in those days there wasn't nearly the information as there is now, you kind of just think that's you. So I actually had a breakdown in 2004, just after I had my second daughter, and I was hospitalised for that. And that was a whole load of life experiences together with bad coping mechanisms, because I think one muddles by as best one can, and you think, oh well, if this happens, this is what I do. And I used to just work harder. And I had very little left in the tank. I had a newborn baby, I was breastfeeding, I was running a production company, I was doing a daily TV show. You know, I was doing too much. So when my then husband, you know, I found out he was having an affair, and then there was keeping it quiet from everybody. Anyway, I just really fell in a heap and I was hospitalized for 5 weeks. And as a condition of get out of hospital, I had to have therapy twice a week for quite a long while, which was a blessing in disguise because I learned another way to cope. I mean, I've always said, like, mental health problems are no different from physical health problems. And if one had, I don't know, high cholesterol, you're going to have some kind of heart attack unless you learn how to cope, what to eat, what not to eat, exercise to do and so on. And the same is exactly the same for depression. I basically had to learn another way to live and to cope and to manage my mental health rather than suffer from it.
How are you feeling now? Because obviously you've been through all of this. How's your mental health now?
Really, strangely, very good. I think the thing that really taught me, because you always wonder, you know, how strong is my mental health? I think once you've had any health scare, you're always a little bit sort of on edge, you can slip back. But when I went through my breast cancer diagnosis in 2008, I think if I was going to get ill or fall in a heap, it would have been then. But what I discovered is that my managing and my coping mechanisms had become not just good enough to make me manage with my mental health and depression, but also really helped with my breast cancer, you know, because it's the same thing, really. I was one of the first people they kept on the medication past 5 years because I didn't have osteoporosis like the large majority of women get on the drug. I use one drug instead of the nice, you know, most women are using 4 or 5. I don't need anything to help me sleep, not very much now and again, I suppose I do. I don't need anything for my bone density. I don't need statins because the drug pushes up cholesterol. So all of the things that I'd learned to do for my mental health actually proved an absolute lifesaver for my physical health. I mean, really, I suppose when you think about it, it's a no-brainer. But
you need something like that to happen, though, don't you? Then start thinking, right, this is what you're going to have to do.
This works.
Definitely. Okay. Now that we've heard about Trisha's depression and mental health issues, after hearing recently that Trisha found out that she was maybe adopted, I wanted to know how this has affected her and her children.
Well, it wasn't so much that I was adopted. It was that the person I thought was my father, was told was my father all my life, wasn't. And I'd always suspected it. I mean, my sisters used to call me the adopted one, you know, and they teased me. And I knew I didn't look anything like them or what have you. In this day and age, I would have worked it out. But when I was growing up in England and in Tanzania and then in Norfolk, there were no other families of colour around. So I couldn't look at them and say, oh, hang on, you know, my sisters are definitely part white, but I'm not. I just went with what I was told. And they did look. I mean, my half-sisters were lighter than my daughters are now. But, you know, I always suspected it. And not until Mummy died in 2004 did my stepfather actually say anything. And that was because my mother was Catholic in those days. Mm. And to have a child out of wedlock, and it was just the shame of it. And so it was really hard at first, because I kind of looked back on a lot of my life as a bit of a lie, because there'd been, I think, so it was like that film about lies, families and secrets and lies about families.
It's a massive thing to then deal with it as well. It's like all those things on top of it.
Yeah, really, I think it was just that it was good and bad, because part of me thought, oh my gosh, I wasn't mad. I wasn't imagining it. I was right. Actually, my sixth sense, if you like, is actually pretty good. You know, I'm pretty good at working things out. So I'm not. So in many ways, it was a relief. But there was a lot of sadness as well, because I've pieced together as much as I can, but I haven't been able to track down who my father was. I'm pretty close. I think I know who it was, but he's since passed away. But, you know, in time, it almost means more to my daughters than it does me. I mean, I would like to know, because there's a lot of health things associated with it as well. Yeah. So, but there you go. Life's not always that easy, is it?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? It's a massive life-changing thing that you had to go through.
Oh, yeah.
So have you always been a very determined lady? Because you've had massive life-changing things that have happened. Have you always been that person, or have you had ups and...
I don't know. I think that often it's the negative things in life that build our character. And somehow I have got together what I'd call it is resilience. Mm. And you don't learn, unfortunately, I wish you did, you don't really learn resilience from everything being hunky-dory. Mm. Some of the people who take things the worst and get knocked back at the worst are people who've gone into adulthood and beyond, living what on paper looks like the ideal life. Mm-hmm. But we only find out our strengths and weaknesses when things go wrong. So I suppose growing up, never fitting in, I never felt I fit in. For many reasons, I didn't, because my sister, you know, and I could sense I was treated differently. I didn't feel I fit in at school. I was lucky in that I was very bright, and I used my brightness as an escape. So I used to spend a lot of time in my head and daydreaming. Mm. Used to get in the cupboard and pretend I'd gone to Narnia, lie on my back and make up countries in the sky. But as I told my younger daughter, because she was dreadfully bullied at school, and she never felt she fit in, because she's like 5'9" and she was been that tall for so long, and she's very gifted, very, very bright girl. Mm. And I said to her, you know what, the plus is, if you never feel you fit in, if you don't fit in, there are two ways of looking at it. You can get really upset about that, or you can think, well, I don't fit in anyway, so I might as well do whatever I want. And I feel sorry, like my eldest daughter was always like what they'd call in America the prom princess, and, you know, always on a pedestal. And I think that's a lot harder. When you never fit in, when you've never been one of the crowd, if you're helped, if somebody helps you see that, eventually, I mean, we used to say to my daughter, look, nobody gets you at the moment. When you get to university, they will. And I mean, she was always the youngest. I mean, she got her master's at 22. She's in management now at 23, and she's just been taken on to do a very accelerated course to be do a master's in social work.
Wow.
And she'll be one of a second lot of specially trained mental health. So she's gone psychology, done mental health, and she's now going to do the fast track social work. And it's a new, and she'll do some law. So it's a new body of people, of social mental health social workers, who will be able to cover the law, sitting on tribunals, working with children, working with the courts, working with the police, because those things have never linked up. Now, she's only just hit her stride at 23. And the people she's working with, the people she manages, the youngest person's probably 26. She does two jobs. She works at AUTUS, which is the King's College conference centre, because she speaks languages. She manages, she's a manager there. And then in her spare time, she works on acute psychiatric wards, and she's been building up her points. You know, she never fit in. So she's never said, oh, I can't do that, or I won't do that because my friends aren't doing it. And I was the same. I was like, well, I'm never going to fit in anyway, so I might as well do what I want to do. Yeah. And that's what's helped me get through.
I think Trisha's determination has helped her to overcome many things throughout her life, and it's clear that she has passed that on to her children. In 2008, Trisha was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she managed to battle through what can only be described as another life-changing situation for her. I wanted to find out how Trisha managed to keep her show going at the same time as having breast cancer.
Well, I was diagnosed in 2008, right after my 50th birthday, and I was sort of on a high. I thought things couldn't get much better. And it was actually, I went in for a running injury, and the lady who was doing the radio, x-rays, said, when's the last x-ray you had? And I said, I don't think I've had one. She said, well, a mammogram would count. She was one of the mums from the school. And I said, oh, I can't remember. She went to check and she said, you're due one, book it now. And she made me book straight away, and I came back anyway. It was all very quick. I went in for one operation, and then they had to do another operation, and I had to have like 6 months of chemo and then radiotherapy. But I still did the show all the time, because Malcolm and I were running the company, we were doing the show. It actually is what kept me going. And I said to everybody, I said to all the staff, look, you're all very sweet, but please, when I come to the studio, don't ask me how I am, because there's 80 of you. I get 80 people asking me how I am, and I'm actually here to not think about how I am. Which was, if I'd pondered on it, very scary, because the first operation I had, I was diagnosed in the evening, and I was I was the last person to go have my bloods taken and everything at Spire Hospital in Norwich. And then the next morning at 6:30 a.m., I went to nuclear oncology before my operation, which is when some lovely person decided to take my photo and send it to the press. I hadn't even told my family. So, I mean, I was going straight into the operating theatre. I didn't have anything. So I didn't know how bad it was. And then when they told me they'd have to operate again, I remember I was like, oh, crap. And the second time, I got a terrible infection. I still hold the record for being drained the most time. It was like a grapefruit under my arm. So all the shows I did then, I put my hand on my hip. But what was so distressing was the smell. It was just, I never felt clean. And I had to be careful with guests. And every so often, I had like three febrile fits. Unfortunately, one was in the bath, which was a little bit dangerous when my daughter and a friend would happen to be there. But, you know, people say, how did you get through? This isn't probably a very PC answer, but I think it's for me that I didn't go to a support group, because my personal experience of, for me, it's different for every woman, sitting around with everybody else talking about it. And it kind of becomes a who's got the worst diagnosis competition.
Mm. Sort of be on your own.
And I don't want to sit around and talk about it.
Yeah.
I'd rather, I mean, I went running when I had keep, and it was, everyone was saying, oh my God, I couldn't do that. How brave. honestly, if you'd seen me at the beginning of the run, I wasn't running. I was literally staggering from tree to tree thinking, can't fall down here. There are nettles. Can't fall down here. There's dog poo.
Running is so important, though. I've run since I've been ill, and it's the one thing that's been enabled me to keep going forward and just trying to do it. It's just makes you feel so much better afterwards. I know.
Doesn't it? And it's goal setting.
Yeah.
It's goal setting because you think, you know, like today I went for a run today, and it's killing me because I did sprint training the other day, and like a fool I didn't stretch. But I think, all right, I'm gonna go to that tree. That's all I have to do, get to that tree. And then you get to that tree and you think, yes, okay, right, now that tree, you know. And my younger daughter used to come with me with her phone because she was scared if something happened to me.
Yeah.
And she hated running. I mean, she wanted, when she was five, she wanted a motorised wheelchair for her birthday because Homer had one in The Simpsons. She never wanted to walk again. And but she came with me running.
Yeah.
And now she's totally into running.
It's great.
And it's really good. And we do that. And what we used to do is get that silly laser game and try and shoot each other. We'd whip each other on the bums with sticks to keep each other going.
Yeah, and running really helps you mentally, and it's good
physically, mentally. So, I don't know about you, it's my meditation. I can run with a problem. When I come back, somehow it's worked its way out.
Like Tricia, running is something that I use to help me to get through to day-to-day issues. Now we come to talk a bit about her charity work. I know that Trish is an ambassador for Mind, but I wanted to find out a little bit more about her other charity work.
I mean, just to chip away at the stigma, I mean, I worked in Australia as a mental health advisor for 10 years to the government. And also Home Start, because that's where good mental health starts, in parenting. So it supports parents who are having difficulties, might be multiple births, or the mother might have depression, or whatever, it doesn't matter. But it's in the old days where the social workers might take the child into care. Home Starter trains up parents, empty nesters, to go and support the families, maybe daily, weekly, what have you. So there wasn't one in Norwich when I came, and I helped start that. And it's still going strong. I'm doing pointless celebrities to earn them some more money while I'm here. But I've always been involved in chipping away at mental health. I spoke at Harlow College in Essex last week. And I did mental health in the media. So I had mental health students, social work students, and television and media and journalist students. And they're sitting there looking at each other thinking, why are we all in the same lecture theatre? And I joined up the dots about positive mental health messages and negative mental health messages and how they affect us and our mental health.
Definitely. That's brilliant. And so what's your secret, Tricia? What is the secret to dealing with life at the moment? What's the whole thing?
So, do you know what? You've said it. It's the same thing as running. It's getting to the next tree. The only difference with the running I do now and before I had breast cancer, I do mindful running now. I take photographs and I support and coach quite a lot of women on my Instagram who've gone through breast cancer. One young lady I met doing Big Brother's bit on the side. She was in a terrible way waiting for a kidney transplant, and it was like, was she going to get one or not? She got one. She's had her operations and she's got through it. And what helped her beforehand was just even walking. And I say, share your pictures online. So they share silly pictures of what they saw. Like someone might take a picture of a dog poo and say, here was my impetus for going past it.
Yeah.
But we share pictures online. So I think that's the same thing in life. It's mindful running applied to life. Take pictures, take time to stop. And when things are really tough, stake out the next tree or the next bush to get to. And when you feel like falling in a heap, be thankful that you're still upright and look at that heap and realise that you really don't want to go face down in a pile of dog poo.
That's good. That's definitely good. So what does the future hold for you? Are you in America? Are you in the UK? What's
the... Bit of both, really. I mean, I ended up in the States. And I just, it's not even America, because America's like Europe. It's so different. It's just where I am, which is just outside New York in a place called Greenwich, Connecticut. And I just made really, really good friends there. And it's funny because I love Norfolk. Don't get me wrong. I really love it. But because we were in the country, you just couldn't go anywhere without getting in a car and driving somewhere. And then in hindsight, best thing I did when I joined NBC was get rid of all my drivers and staff and go by train and walk everywhere. And I met people on the train. I work for a couple of charities. One is, if you know Nile Rodgers and Chic, the band Chic, they have the We Are Family Foundation. And Nile Rodgers and his partner Nancy and Falami and Kay and the whole band have really taken me in. And we work with kids, supporting kids from all over the world. TEDx Teen is one of theirs. And then the other one I work with is Opening Act, which works with the toughest schools in New York and a lot of famous actors and actresses, like the cast from Orange is the New Black and Joshua Jackson, and go in very quietly to these schools, and we work with these young people to on what we're talking about on outlook and resilience. And I mean, I went to one school not long ago and the security was worse than at the airport. I mean, I wanted to take a picture, but you couldn't. Please, no guns, weapons beyond this point. Yeah. I mean, these schools, no, it's fantastic. Okay. Because when you're actually working en masse from outside, I remember me and this woman were looking for this address and we couldn't find it. And there was all this like corrugated sheeting. And we said, well, it should be here. And it was. This school was behind it. From the street, you felt you could run away. But when we went in and we worked with these kids, and I will work with them all the time for the last lot for 3 years, the kids we saw at the beginning and the kids who left are two totally different, just completely different things. And it's just amazing. And they do a play with all these famous people on the last, after 3 years. And these kids who may not have been able to have eye contact or talk to you, or young gay people who were literally in fear of their lives for coming out, when you see them 3 years later, it's just, I can't tell you, it's just amazing. So I discovered that, and I got a really good bunch of really good friends, and it's on the beach and I love the sea. And I just love where I am. But I come back to England, my daughters are here, they come out to the States, I come here, and I actually see them more than when I was in Norfolk and they were in London, because they're like, well, do we want to come home to Norfolk, Mum? Whereas it's like, oh, New York, goody goody goody. And I come back here and work, and, you know, it just works for me. It's only 5.5 hours flight.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the train,
fantastic,
train to Norwich can take 4 hours. It can
indeed. A11. Sometimes you get stuck on it, don't you?
Oh, yeah, in Colchester. God, I've got caught in Colchester so many times.
Now we've heard about Trisha's charity work, Mindful Running, I finally wanted to find out how Trisha deals with anxiety and what coping methods she actually uses.
I think the worst anxiety I ever had was I'd had my first operation after breast cancer, and I was given these very, very strong painkillers like Cocodamol and things like that. And I knew I couldn't do the show like that. And so Ruth, a lady called Ruth from Mind, came along and taught me pain management and relaxation. Now, I'm terrible. I think if I was at school now, I'd be labelled ADHD, because I'm just on the go all the time. So for me to sit still and meditate and relax, I'm like, yeah, hurry up. And I was kind of cynical that it would work. One, I went to the studio. We were at Maidstone then. I was in the hotel with Security Pete, if you remember him.
Oh, I remember Security, Pete.
And he was in his room. I was in mine. And I woke up and I thought, oh, God, I can't do this. The pain. And I'm a toughie because I work out and I run. But this pain when pain obliterates thought, you can't even have a joined up thought because yeah. it's just, and you and I was panicking. I thought, oh, what have I done? Mm. I've got no painkillers. I've got these painkillers, but I couldn't take them until I'd eaten because they were so strong. Mm. And I was lying on the bed and I remember I was in such pain, I couldn't feel the bed.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, how am I going to get up? How am I going to get up? And I completely was panicking. And I remember saying, you've got to get a grip. And it was like someone screaming down a rabbit hole to actually get through to my head. I knew what I had to do, but I couldn't do it. And then I remembered Ruth and I was like, it won't bloody work anyway. But I tried it and it started working little by little and I got myself upright and I managed to just put some flannel on my face and get some. And I remember going like this and I managed to get myself out of that panic state. It took like half an hour. But it did teach me something. It did teach me. I thought I'd never come back from that.
Yeah.
But I did.
You learn from your mistakes.
You learn from your mistakes. Mm. But I still have to say, it doesn't mean that the next time, like when I had my febrile fit in the bath, I tried to apply the same panic anti sort of to get hold of the anxiety. But because I was in a bath and slipping, it was... So, I don't know. I think once you recognise that it's a factor in your life,
you have to deal with it.
Then you have to deal with it. Yeah, I think the people who've suffered the most don't even know that's what it is.
Yeah,
I think once you name the beast and you start creating some strategies for keeping it at bay, you feel a little bit more in control. And I think anxiety is triggered by the fear of anxiety as much as anything else.
You've been listening to The Longest Battle here on RNIB Connect Radio with me, Emma Martins, and my guest, the wonderful Tricia Goddard. If you'd like to find out more about mental health, do visit mind.org.uk.